because we've got only a minute before our next program, and I know we've got some messages from the station to throw at you. So this is Paul Roland with KBOO Radio, Wednesday Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/FuzzyBoo.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's on Hawthorne in Portland. Guerrillas of Desire argues that the left is wrong. The strategies are often based on the assumption that working and poor people are unorganized or simply uninterested in building a new world. Again, that's Guerrillas of Desire book launch with Kevin Van Meter on Thursday, August 10th at 7:30 at Powell's Books, 3723 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, on political perspectives, we'll get the latest report from Kabul with Dr. Zahir Wahab and his wife, Tamina. They're visiting KBOO, and they'll have recent news from Afghanistan. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And then at 11 o'clock, stay tuned for a look at the Portland Fruit Tree Project. And also a master gardener will be here to answer your questions about fall gardening. And in case you didn't notice, KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we always need your help. You can go to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member. And by the way, during the next hour, Dr. Zahir Wahab and Linda will be taking a few of your calls toward the end of the hour, so stay tuned for that. Thanks for tuning into KBOO today.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Political Perspectives. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, your host today, and today we're talking about Afghanistan. I have a guest for you that many of you have probably already heard in the past. We have him on here regularly when we can. His name is Professor Zahir Wahab. For 40 years, he was here at Lewis and Clark, a mainstay of teaching there and teaching about teaching. And for the last 10 years, he's also been going back to the country he was born in, which is Afghanistan. He received his BA originally from the American University of Beirut. He went on to get a master's degree in education at Columbia, a master's degree in anthropology, and finally a PhD in international development education. And that's really what he has been doing for the last 10 years. He's been working actively in Afghanistan to develop education and the teachers who will be teaching the future of Afghanistan. He's also, of course, because he's there in the middle of it and an Afghani by birth, very well informed about most aspects of what's happening in Afghanistan. So welcome to KBOO, Professor.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you for having me, and good morning to you and to our listeners. Actually, I've been going back for 16 years.
It's been 16 years. I knew it was over 10, but yeah.
Soon after the invasion of the country and the dislodging of the Taliban, I have been going every year, spending maybe a semester and or so. But for the last 3 years, I have been there full time.
Yes. And so you return to the Portland area once or twice a year. And so we here get to have you. I say that we get to have you. You do a lot of speaking and meeting with people about Afghanistan. A lot of people who've known you through the years and want to hear from you about what's happening.
Yes, we have been doing that, and but I would like for this to end.
we don't have to talk
about this tragedy and this atrocity. It gets tiring, and it's very painful to be doing this year after year after year. And I'm sorry to report to you that things today are much worse than, say, they were when the last time we spoke here, or a year ago, or, say, 10 years ago.
Do you want to begin with the conditions in Afghanistan right now?
Well, we could talk about what I'm doing right now and why, and then go from there.
Okay, let's do that. And talk about your mission there, really. You're there on a mission. I know that's not what it's called, but you are.
Well, in a way, yes. I feel very strongly about this, and I feel very bad to be caught in the middle. My adopted country waging war, a vicious war, on my country of origin. So it's a very bad position to be in, and we have to deal with this. So as I said, for the last 3 years, I have been working full-time at the American University of Afghanistan. It's a university that the former Minister of Higher Education, who is also an American, Afghan-American PhD, was the first Minister of Higher Education in 2002 until 2006. And I was advisor to the Ministry of Higher Education initially. So we decided early on that what the country needed was a model liberal arts institution, which was lacking in the country. So we began working on establishing this modern liberal arts institution that could serve as an example of a good higher education.
One of the important things about that is, as most modern universities of this sort are, is it's both male and female.
Yes.
Something that people don't often think is possible in Afghanistan.
Yes. Well, our idea really was that this would be a modern liberal arts, secular, non-denominational, not-for-profit institution, and that's what it is. It's the only university in the country, perhaps, that is not-for-profit, except for the public institutions. And it has the highest percentage of female students. About 40% of our students are women, girls, and maybe 30% of the faculty are women, mostly internationals. And we try to be as close to a good modern university as we can under the circumstances. And comparing to the other public institutions or the private institutions, it's considered to be the best university in the country right now.
And are you having graduating classes?
Yes. We have two master's degree programs, and we have four undergraduate programs. And then there are a lot of specialized, sort of custom-made special workshops and seminars and programs. But the university finally began working in 2006. We have just had our sixth commencement.
I know commencements are pretty darn exciting when you're a small and new university.
Yeah, I missed this last one because we returned to Portland. But anyway, it's a university, which looks and feels and smells like a university. It has a pretty good faculty, a very large percentage of PhDs. It has a pretty current modern curriculum and has good facilities,
fast. Are those all inside the green zone?
No. Actually, the university is very close to the Afghan parliament, which is close to the palace that was built by King Amanullah about 100 years ago. It's sort of on the western outskirts of Kabul city in a very nice area. And it has a pretty decent campus, a fairly large campus. And as I said, it's the only university that has students from all of the 34 provinces, because we send our admissions office to find the best and the brightest, and we will find a way for them to study. So half of the students are on a full scholarship, including dormitory, food, lodging, books, and they're exempt from tuition. And essentially, we have two kinds of students, poor but very bright students, and then rich and not so bright students. And they're the ones who pay. And it has a fairly high tuition comparing, to the per capita income of the country. But I think if I may take a moment, when people talk about the university here, you talk about nice green lawns and open spaces, no barriers, no walls, no fences, no guards, no sniffing dogs.
Yeah, some of the prettiest places in any town to go to would be your university campuses, yes.
Unfortunately, AUF, as you know, about a year ago, two of our faculty were abducted. One American, one Australian. They're still at large and in captivity. And then about a year ago, the university was attacked massively by three suicide bombers with a car packed with explosives, where we lost 16 people, faculty, students, and guard. And since then, there have been numerous threats. And so right now, we live on under maximum security conditions, which is to say, the university is surrounded by very thick, high blast walls, and then watchtowers, armed guards, 24 hours a day, walking all over, dogs, scanners, cameras.
Not a university experience that many have around the world. To be there, wanting to learn, and with people your own age and people going through the same kind of things, but at the same time to have to be surrounded by that kind of security because you could be killed.
Essentially, it looks like a prison.
Yeah.
I mean, we, the expatriates, we're not allowed to leave the campus except for emergencies. We have all our needs taken care of on campus, from barbers to food, to dry cleaning, and we really aren't allowed to leave the campus except when there's an emergency. This is our life. Essentially, we live and work under conditions of siege.
And that leads me to the current conditions in Afghanistan,
yeah.
Period. There's been a lot of stuff going on in the news about Afghanistan. Should we add more troops or not? Privatizing, we can get to all of that.
Yes.
But maybe you could tell us the basic circumstances of the nation now.
Yeah. Well, if you took a plane and landed in Kabul, you will see the concern with security, and you will see almost the violence and the effects of violence. Right now, in terms of security, there really is no safety and security anywhere. You are not safe in your house, in your place of work, in your school, on your way to work, in the mosque, or observing, say, an athletic event. You are not safe anywhere, anytime.
A funeral, a wedding party, we know.
Weddings,
that
funerals, birthday parties. People have been bombed, or there are explosions, of one kind or another. Just about 3 days ago, there was a massive massacre in Saripul, which is the central province of Afghanistan. And they think it was the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. Right now, there are at least 20 different insurgent groups fighting.
And that's a really important point, because I think if you asked most Americans who was fighting who in Afghanistan, they'd probably say Taliban
versus,
or Al-Qaeda versus U.S.
Right.
and the Afghan government. We might be lucky to get that much of an answer. So what's really happening is many more forces are armed and holding territory.
The Afghan situation has become very complicated. Initially, of course, it was the Taliban versus the Americans and the Afghan government. But right now, as I said, over the last, 17 years, new groups have emerged, new mafias have emerged, new interest groups, and there are new countries that are meddling in the affairs of the country. So now you have the Qaeda, for example, the original group. You have the Taliban, you have the Haqqani group, you have the new ISIS group that came from Syria and Iraq. But you also have sort of other smaller criminal syndicates, like you have the drug mafia, you have the timber mafia.
So is the poppy production going forward still?
It's the highest. This year, production has been the highest in the last 16 or 17 years. in spite of some token efforts by the Americans in the UN and the Afghan government to eradicate. And remember, this was one of the allegedly one of the goals of the Bush administration when they launched the attack, to eliminate. On the contrary, drug production, drug processing, and drug consumption in the country have increased enormously because people have to make a living. And also, when conditions are insecure and unsafe, when there's no peace, that's those situations rife for crime and criminality of all kinds.
And so we have dueling mafias. There's been a lot in the news recently. Yeah. In fact, maybe you recall that our President Trump has been recorded, and I've seen the recording of him talking about, you know, the to the victors go the spoils.
Yeah.
And he's being advised by a variety of people to consider privatizing the war.
Yes.
There. A part of this has to do with, and it would be paid for by all the minerals that would be extracted. Can you talk a little bit about all this? There's a lot in the news about the minerals in Afghanistan and
yes.
international interest in those.
Yes. Well, some would say Afghanistan is cursed by its geography and its resources.
Iran on one side, Pakistan on another, the Uzbekistan's up above.
Yes, yes. There are proxy wars between, say, Iraq and, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, between Pakistan and India, between the Americans and the Iranians, between the Russians and the Iranians, between, say, other countries and the Afghan government. So there are multiple skirmishes going on. But supposedly, and I think it's true, the country is very rich in minerals. Several surveys have indicated that the country has enormous and some very precious resources, namely lithium. In fact, I think there are talks underway between the Afghan government and the German government to see if they can explore the lithium in Helmand provinces.
I saw on the web, I looked at some of the stuff, and I saw the processing of lapis lazuli,
yes,
emeralds,
yes.
and other gems.
Gold, yeah, and gems.
Yeah, other gems, and they're already being processed by some
criminals.
By whoever's holding the territory where that mine
yes.
is.
Yes.
I spoke to a gentleman on the street. We were talking. He had turned out to be at a talk of yours, and he and I started talking in my neighborhood, and he thought, oh, well, this mining cannot really be something the big countries want, or why haven't they already gone in and taken it? But I think it's because, I mean, what I can read is that this is a very disputed area geographically, and it's
yeah.
never been stabilized in war, you know, it's always in warfare in those areas.
Yes. Well, it's sort of an area historically, if you can recall, several empires and emperors have gone through there, you know, like Genghis Khan, Timur Lane, you know, the Brits, and then the Russians, and now the Americans and NATO. So, and yet the country has not quite been subdued. And I think geographically also is sort of the connecting space between Central Asia and then Europe and other places, and also South Asia. Right now, but I want to go back to the privatization of the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're into the seventh month or so of the Trump administration, and there still doesn't seem to be a definitive policy developed regarding Afghanistan. But as you pointed out, we hear in the press, you know, that there's serious discussion going on about outsourcing the war to the two organizations, mainly Blackwater and DynCorp. In fact, Eric Prince, who is the founder owner of Blackwater, now named Akademe or something, he had an article in the Wall Street Journal saying that the best solution to Afghanistan's problem is to, because the issue is the resources, the minerals, so to privatize it and appoint, as he put it, an American viceroy and manage the country directly, the way the British did the Indian subcontinent.
Yeah, and then, I saw him also. You can see him talking about it. There's a video online about him talking about this.
Yes. So now there are serious discussions, and people think that the Trump administration might be thinking about sort of turning the war over to these two and other organizations, but also there's an American, I think it's called American Elements. It's a vast chemical corporation, American corporation, and the head of that corporation has also been involved in the discussions. All of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the National Security Advisor, the Defense Minister, have gone and visited Afghanistan, but not the Secretary of the State. So in the meantime, the war continues, and it's heating up, and it's...
Let's stick on the privatization plan. I was reading some of the specifics of it. Apparently, they presented... Kushner, his son-in-law, brought Prince in. I think his name is Feinberg.
Feinberg,
who's head of DynaCorp. And brought them in and had conversations with them. And they presented a plan of 5,500 paid mercenaries and another 90 aircrafts that would be a private air force.
Yes.
And that they would go in and secure some of the mineral rights and hold those and be the army to hold those. For extraction, and the extraction would pay for them being there.
Yes.
There isn't anything in there that says anything about the interests
country,
of
the
Afghanistan
people,
or the interests of the American public, really.
That's right.
They're just saying, you know, we can get rid of this problem, a war for you, by just running it ourselves.
Yes.
Also, the issue of, you know, when you're a member of a corporation, your duty is to them. Oh, I also wanted to say Blackwater. Just yesterday, I read that Blackwater had been convicted of a crime in Iraq against civilians, and they just got that overturned.
Yes, so, I heard that too.
That was the first time Blackwater or these kinds of mercenaries had been held accountable for human rights violations, but they've been known to do them in other sources, and now that's been overturned. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, as a matter of fact, they were convicted of a similar crime in Afghanistan, and I know the story, but we don't want to spend time on it, but in Afghanistan, once there were three Blackwater guys driving in their SUV along this road, it's a public road, and there was an accident with a taxi, and these three people get out and start shooting at random. And one of the people who, a young man who was shot, happens to be the nephew of one of my students.
Yeah.
And so I have pictures of this man, a huge young man, you know. He was on his way from his English classes to go home. And he was a football star, you know, a wonderful young man having nothing to do with this. He was shot from behind. I went and visited him in the hospital. I have pictures of him, actually. And when these three Blackwater guys, eventually they were tried in Virginia and were found to be guilty and were found to be drunk at the time when they did this mass, you know, random shooting. And yet these are the people, which is interesting, because then if this is the war is outsourced and privatized because of its resources, it would sound like this is someplace in the North Pole or someplace out in the ocean with no people but resources to mine. But that's imperialism, you know, that's the new imperialism. So get what you can and forget about the people.
Well, and to the victors go the spoils. What victory has there been for the people of the United States or the people of Afghanistan in this war? There's been nothing. I can't think of anything that we've gained in terms of security or anything else.
Unfortunately, you know, as we have spoken around this desk for years and years, as I keep saying, there hasn't been peace or prosperity. There has not been democracy. You have a highly dysfunctional, polarized, fractured, illegitimate government. The drug industry is larger than ever, you know, with 3 million Afghans using drugs and 1.5 million hardcore addicts.
Which was something you didn't see before before poppy production was
Sort of an industrial scale.
I, And I will say that it seems that poppy production goes where the U.S. is militarily invested, as it did in the Vietnam.
In Central Asia, Central America.
It moves where we move.
Yes, it seems. It's not surprising.
I mean, whether you can prove the involvement of the CIA or U.S. forces or not, somehow the drug trade moves with us.
Yes, it seems like, well, in war... and instability, insecurity, poor governance, and foreign intrusion, they seem to go together. And that's what's happening in Afghanistan. Clearly, if you look at the graphs of the drug production, it has increased steadily by the year since 2002.
Is there a particular group that's in control of the drug production? Is it the Taliban or is it other?
The Taliban only, they collect taxes. Yes, the Taliban, they're not involved in the cultivating or drug production, but they do collect taxes. This is one of their major sources of their income.
Interesting.
And the same with other criminal groups. But essentially what it is there's a lot of money to be made by the intermediaries, the local and the international mafia. And we certainly know from government documents and UN documents that the international mafia is involved. There have been, numerous sort of indications that perhaps some of the foreign troops were involved in ferrying the drugs outside of the country. But I can't say this. But there certainly are many, many groups involved in benefiting. And the poor farmer who has nothing, no other way to feed his family, has to resort to this because the land has gone bad. There has been a drought for years and years. And there's no other kind of economy, a legitimate economy. So people resort to...
And meanwhile, Afghanistan has to import much of its food.
Yes.
So growing poppies, but not because there's profit in that, but not being able to grow food because there isn't stability to get it to markets and there's not the profit that a organized crime would look for in that.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing, that a country where 80% of the people are engaged in agriculture, and yet at the end of the year, it's a net food importer.
Yes.
So
we're about halfway through our time, so I want to let the public out there, all our listeners, know that we are going to be opening the phones at about 9:30. We want to give you a chance to bring the questions, the thoughts, the worries and concerns or opinions that you have to Professor Wahab while he's here. You're not going to have a better chance to talk to someone who actually knows what's happening there and has the personal experience of it. So that number to call is 503-231-8187. We'll open the lines in just a few minutes, so go ahead and call if you have a question or a concern. Do that right now. So what I'm getting as a picture of the whole of Afghanistan is one of kind of constant chaos. I was reading a series of stories about a taking over of one province in a small town.
Kunduz, Kunduz province.
And then next to Ghor province, and then Helmand down below, and Tamara or something like that. And that. So there are the people trying to hold that land for the Afghani government and they were defending their parliamentarian who comes from Kabul, comes to here to fight off. And there was a large Taliban
assault
where they brought Taliban members from across the area, across the region, and did this major assault. Then it was overturned and taken over again by Afghan government forces. In the meantime, all the people who live in that area are in total chaos. I would think just the issue of if you're friendly to one force, what does another force want to do to you?
Yes. Well, it's not just chaos, but it's also very violent chaos.
Yes.
Right now, as we speak, there's fighting going on in 22 of the 34 provinces.
Wow.
In the early decade or so, the fighting was sort of limited to in the south and southeast area. Right now, it's all over the country, way up north in Kunduz province that you mentioned, I think. The Kunduz was taken over twice, and it's now almost the insurgents are on the periphery of Kunduz city, which is very close to Tajikistan. The border. So there's fighting going on in 22 of the 34 provinces. The insurgents control about half of the country and half of the population. In some places, the insurgents collect in many cases, they collect taxes instead of the government. And even this goes on in their provincial capitals, like Ghazni province, for example, or Lashkargah or other places. So the insurgency is, in some cases, it's sort of permanent targets. In other cases, the insurgency is moving. It's mobile. It simply wants to harass the government, and they would occupy a local government precinct and keep it for a while and then leave it, or the government forces would come in. So it's cat and mouse game in some parts of the country.
And the people who live there.
It's very hard. It's very hard to plan your life, when you can't count on anybody, when there's no stability, there's no predictability, there's no safety or security. 2 million Afghans have been displaced internally, not to say 4 million Afghans who are still outside the country in Pakistan, in Iran, but hundreds of thousands of people are displaced internally because there's fighting going on, or because they just can't make a living. They ran out of land or water or food or whatever.
And if they travel to a different area, say they have relatives in a different area, they're never sure who's going to be in control of that land at a later time.
That's right. And there are land disputes, when people return, which is kind of rare. And so if you go to any big city now, in the city or on the periphery of any city, you see these vast tent cities, kind of like camps, of the local people who have been displaced from, where there's fighting. This is a major problem.
I know, and we've seen the government, people freezing to death in Kabul because of that.
Freezing to death or dying to death almost because
in
it's
those
very
tent
hot.
Cities.
The hot. And the government is unable really to provide for these people. As I said, what we have done is, empower and put in place some of the worst elements in the country. The government is illegitimate. It has no, in fact, legal constitutional basis. The parliament, the executive, and the Supreme Court, their terms have expired, or they were extra-constitutional, extra-legal, because the government was put together by John Kerry, Secretary
so there's
of State,
not, there's
2 years ago.
And it doesn't have the capacity to actually respond and help with people. We have someone on the phone.
Well, it could, because it has a lot of money.
Edie, thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much. Professor, could you please tell us what we here in Portland can be doing to be doing our part to help change and make things better in any way?
Yes, thank you for the call. Well, I would say, not just Portland, but all over America. I think the public needs to inform itself, because other than occasional articles by the New York Times or the Washington Post, there's very little coverage of Afghanistan. It is indeed sort of the forgotten war, even though it has been the most expensive trillion-dollar war and the deadliest. But there's very little discussion of it and very little serious critical analysis of the war as to what the goals are and how we're doing or how they're doing, and should we continue being there. I think what people need to do in America to demand good governance, both in this country and in other places, but also to put pressure on the U.S. government to mind its own business first and become a good model where other people would want to become like America. Right now, I'm sorry to say that if you go to Afghanistan, even though the country depends on foreign intervention, foreign support, and foreign assistance, but there are very few people who actually like the United States or foreigners, or including the UN, because people have not seen much what these foreigners have done for them. So the idea again is, unfortunately, we had a chance to elect a good government, but we chose the other way, and I think people just need to inform themselves and make connections between, say, foreign and domestic policies, choose a demilitarized way of solving problems and, you know, put pressure on the government to deal with American isolation in another way other than military intervention all over the world. You know, what we do is we keep destroying these countries one at a time. You know, it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, and other places. People need to stay active and stay involved and keep pressuring the government.
Edie, did that answer your question?
Well, I already knew we have to do that, but I guess I was asking how to do that.
Well, maybe Linda has.
I want to make one suggestion, which is, since it's in the news, in the New York Times, and it's been on other big news about this suggestion for privatization, is get yourself educated about that and inform your senators and inform your congresspeople about not allowing that to go forward. There's something very seductive, I think, for our memories is to turn that war over and just pay for it and not. I have heard good liberal people say, well, I don't really like the drones, but at least our troops, our boys aren't dying. And there's so much glorification of our troops, our boys, that the idea that we can do this war without them dying could be very appealing. And I think personally that's one point that ought to be taken up really big. And I, you know, if you'll do it, Edie, I'll do it. I'll call our senators and I'll call our congressmen and say, don't allow this to go forward. Don't let these mercenaries get their hands in there. I mean, we already use contractors.
I'm going to do that at Ron Wyden's next town hall.
That's great.
Yeah, yes, and also to engage in public diplomacy, maybe, you know, try to send people to Afghanistan, you know, groups, whatever you name them, to find out for themselves, you know, fact-finding missions, public diplomacy, people-to-people contacts, instead of putting a human face on the war and the enormous pain and suffering that we're inflicted, and not we, but you know, the U.S. government is inflicting on people 10,000 miles away.
They couldn't do it with us saying, "Okay, you can use our tax dollars to kill these people over there." I mean, we don't sign a little oath that says that, but somehow we're the ones that the money's coming away from, and it's being used to kill them. And I think that's another place we need to find a way to stop that.
Yeah.
Stop the money going there. Edie, thank you very much for your call. I want to let people know what the number is. It's 503-231-8187. I wondered if you could address the question of women in Afghanistan today. And I know that you teach with young women.
Yes.
And I assume you have some women professors that you also work with in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Could you talk about the situation for women, and both as you know it from the young women coming from different provinces, but also more.
Well, my wife, Tahmina, stepped out.
I know,
she
just
could
for a
answer
minute,
this.
We should have announced that she was here.
I mean, in the area of women and in education, I would say some progress has been made numerically, quantitatively. So the situation of women, as you know, was dire, needless to say, in 2001 and prior to 2001. Since then, you know, more women and girls go to school and universities, more women work. So if you look at school enrollment, K through 12th, about 40% of the students are girls.
And these are schools that are outside the major...
All over the country, all over, except I should say that in some provinces, for example, there is hardly any high school for girls. And in some cases, girls are not allowed to continue their schooling beyond third grade.
Are people literate? At what stage are people literate in the sense that they can read, they can write,
no,
and they can
illiteracy
do mathematics?
It's a scandal. You know, here is a country in 2017 where 85% of the women are illiterate. 85% of the women are illiterate, and 70% of the men are illiterate. So it's horrible.
It makes long-term communication very difficult.
It makes
because
everything.
There aren't documents that they can read or keep or take with them. It makes
right.
people dependent.
It makes everything difficult.
Especially when the fabric of villages and stuff is broken up, because I would assume before, even with illiteracy, people would have the structures and ways that they would be able to get a letter sent or a document verified.
Yes,
but
And, you know, people are in the dark when people can't read and write people can't read and write their name. You know, they're in the dark. They don't know the world around them. They don't know their rights and duties. They don't behave like citizens, for example, and they're deprived. So women in the universities, for example, about 20% of the university students, both in public and private, are women. About 15% of the university instructors are women. About 75% of the school teachers in the cities are women. But the majority of the women, as I said, 85% illiteracy, the majority of the women are still married off very early. 80% of the marriages take place before the legal age. Little girls are sold, essentially, and married off.
For dowry.
Women still, a woman in Afghanistan cannot go and get an apartment for herself, not even in the capital city, for example. Marriage is arranged even for educated women and families, for example. Women still have more than a glass ceiling. You know, there are thick walls around women restricting their freedom. They're harassed on the street and in the workplaces. There are a few token women in higher positions. Most of them, those who work in the public or private sector or the NGOs, are at the lower levels. But again, as you leave the cities, women continue to live, labor, and die the way they did in the Middle Ages.
Wow. I did hear one thing that I felt was really interesting. I heard it on the news today. There was some young Afghani woman that was here for a robotics exhibition.
Yes, the group.
And there was a lot of attention to that. And we do tend to do that here in the United States. We get some young woman who is remarkable and whose parents have been remarkable, and they should be honored. But we get them and we think of that as, see, there's the example.
Yes. Don't have to do anything else.
But I heard this morning that her father was killed in an attack.
Yes,
and I don't know if part of why he was killed was because his daughter went abroad and was seen to be in public doing something they didn't want women to do or not. I thought, wow, that's a lot to lose.
I mean, I think this happens, like the Malala syndrome. I call it the Malala syndrome.
She was the woman
the girl who was attacked in Pakistan. And now turned into a heroine, or Malala Joyar, the Afghan woman who...
Legislator.
That's
who I was thinking of as well. We gave a lot of attention to her, and rightfully so. She was a strong advocate for the rights of women and...
Yes.
Openly talking about the warlords that were then in the government, but we haven't heard much lately, and I'm assuming that's because she can't have much of a public persona.
I mean, I think the media does that, would elevate somebody domestically too, and then that person is consumed, and life is back to normal or usual. I mean, if you apply the Human Development Index to Afghanistan right now. Half of the people are poor. Half of the people are unemployed. 85% of the women are illiterate. 80% of the girls are married off when they're little. They're sold literally like goats, any other commodity. People don't have enough to eat. Their health care is terrible. A woman cannot go alone
imagine giving birth is quite dangerous.
Yes, and this happens, the mortality in childbirth. We get the usual statistics, lack of electricity, lack of drinking water, housing, diet, freedom to move, freedom to vote.
Where the U.S. is established, I know the last time that you were here, we talked about they were building one of the largest bases in the world, U.S. military base.
And the largest military embassy, the second largest.
Are those kinds of places ever a resource for the regular people? Like, if they need to go to a doctor, they could go to the base.
No.
I
couldn't go proudly. I would have to really pull a lot of strings.
Putting probably that base will cost billions. Can you talk about that?
Yes.
The largest embassy
in Kabul. Yes. The troop reduction that took place in 2014, where most of the American forces were withdrawn, quite a bit of the military hardware was destroyed, scrapped actually. I remember talking about this. the U.S. spent about $8 billion to destroy the military hardware instead of turning it over to the Afghan security forces. So Bagram is one of the biggest military airports or bases. Kandahar, Jalalabad, Mazar in Herat, Shindand. And then at the time we talked about, and I have been to the embassy, of course. Mm-hmm. I have not been to the Bagram base. But the embassy, our embassy is the second biggest embassy in the world after Baghdad. And I understand they're building the third largest in Islamabad. And you would wonder, you know, if there, unless there are some long-term plans for this country or this geography, why would you want to build these permanent, you know, huge multi-billion dollar structures when, you know, the Afghan children can't get vaccine or pencils
or nutritious food so that they can grow healthy?
Yeah, so you can see the priorities. And now I think with this question of privatization, and this will be the ultimate of vulgarity, it seemed, because we know what the private sector does, or privatization. They're interested in making money. They're not interested about, you know, in human conditions or people suffering.
Well, and they've
suffering.
Actually written the rules of corporations so that yes. their largest, most important responsibility is to make profit, not to
yes.
to make
to
a product, not to
public service.
Yeah, not to in any way be yeah. contributing.
I mean, this should be the issue. This should become the issue in this country, you know, the outsourcing, privatization of the occupations, foreign occupations, you know, and what would this do to the U.S.'s image abroad in the U.S. relationship in public attitudes? And this proves the others right when in Afghanistan, people really say that the United States is not here and didn't come to Afghanistan to bring peace, progress, prosperity, democracy, human rights, et cetera, et cetera, but to pursue its own agenda, and that is to counter the Chinese, the Iranians, the Russians.
Chinese have a copper mine there.
Not just that, but the China now has the biggest plan, you know, this One Belt, One Road plan, economic plan that will essentially link the whole world together. And it goes through the heart of Afghanistan. So that's why, that's the China plan. And the Chinese are very much involved now. In Afghanistan, they're trying to stabilize the situation, which the Americans don't like.
No, I was going to say, and the Chinese are not coming in with huge amounts of military and killing all of the locals,
right?
Which makes them highly more desirable. I believe we do have another caller on the line.
Fine.
It's Dennis, and I do want to let other people know the number. Right. We still have time for you to call in. It's 503-231-8187. And then, Dennis, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Way back at the beginning of this war, I remember something called the Northern Alliance, which were these warlords or these people who they weren't the Taliban, and they were, but they were. It seems to me that they were considered very dangerous. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes. And there are good books about this. You know, First In is a very good book by an American commando who went before October 7, 2001, and sort of entered Afghanistan through Tajikistan and Kunduz province, and then came to Panjshir. The Northern Alliance was the major coalition that was fighting the Taliban, and it was basically Tajik ethnically Tajik. And the Taliban were mostly Pashtuns, of course. So the Northern Alliance was this loose coalition, and not so loose, actually, of Tajiks fighting the Taliban. And when the Americans moved in October 2001, the Northern Alliance, their leadership was actually paid tons and tons of money by these commandos, American commandos, in the northern part of the country to buy their favor. So they saw their interest in American invasion, and the Americans, of course, needed intermediaries, locals, you know, to work with. So it was a perfect match, you know. And since then, of course, and then when the invasion happened, the Northern Alliance moved very quickly into Kabul and took over government buildings, embassies, ministries, you know, nice parts of the city, housing, positions, etc. And, you know, and then there was the so-called Bonn Conference in December 2001 that sort of put a government together, a nominal Pashtun president, Mr. Hamid Karzai, but the rest of the government and the real power was in the hands of the Northern Alliance. That sort of continued for years until the end of the Karzai administration. The new administration, Mr. Ashraf Ghani's administration, is trying to sort of balance. I think it's trying to balance and placate different ethnic groups. So it moves people around. But in terms of the warlord label, I think I can say that most people in power in Afghanistan, whether they're in the government, outside the government, or against the government, are in one way or another a warlord and also a war criminal. I think there should be mass trials in the Nuremberg, like the Nuremberg trials, to put these people on trial for their atrocities against Afghans, the Afghan people.
Are these any of these people in the area of Herat?
Yes, of course. Herat is very problematic in terms of crime and criminality. You know, it's very difficult to do any business. That's one thing that the war has done, all these years of turmoil have done, is to sort of gangsterize and vulgarize and criminalize the society. You know, crime is rampant. It's out of control. So people don't feel safe to either invest or travel or make plans or do anything. And people are taking their money out. And, you know, you have these shadow governments or in terms of warlords. They are in and out of the government. And when they're out of the government, they still have, you know, private militias in private prisons. This operates as we speak.
Well, can you give me is there a name of a particular warlord that is dominant?
Well, you know, there are several, actually. You know, Mr. Sherzai, who was a major warlord in Kandahar and then made governor and minister, was out and now again appointed Minister of Tribal Affairs. He's famous, you know, as a drug lord and as a warlord and as a butcher.
How do you spell his last name?
Sherzai. Or you take Mr. Hikmatyar, who was on the U.S. blacklist. He was at one point, you know, he was one of the major Mujahideen leaders and then became prime minister in the Mujahideen government and then fought with his own cohorts, was exiled and was put on the U.S.-UN blacklist and was just brought back a few months ago. And so he lives across AUF now. And you can name a lot of people like that. People in the government, the people call the Afghan government as a sort of an incorporated a company because, you know, you have to sort of balance these different ethnic groups and power groups. Otherwise, nothing gets done. But in addition to trying all this, still very little is being done. There's no government, essentially, because it can't deliver the goods and services that you would expect a government to deliver.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, and we still have time for another call. The number is 503-231-8187. There's so much to talk about Afghanistan. The program Democracy Now! has been covering some issues with Afghanistan, and they had on it Kathy Kelly, who's a famous activist in support of nonviolence, and she's traveled to Afghanistan many times. So I wanted to let people know about that so that if you are thinking, well, maybe I'm one of the people who could actually go and meet people in Afghanistan, Kathy Kelly's organization is the one to look at. Creative Nonviolence.
Yeah, Creative Nonviolence, yeah.
And you can look her up under her name, Kathy Kelly, or you can look her
up. She writes for Common Dreams.
Common Dreams. And but she was on, and there was also a person from Global Witness, and they were being asked, did they think the United States troops should stay there? And the person from Global Witness said they don't take a stand on that, but she sort of said, but basically, yes, because otherwise it would be chaos.
Yes.
Kathy Kelly said, though, I think we should pull out because it's chaos now, and we're just one of the warlords.
Yes,
and we're not doing any good there now. We're not stabilizing the situation. We're not aiding anybody.
Right.
We should leave and let the Afghani people sort it out. I wondered if you wanted to sort of weigh in on between those two kinds of points of view.
I think you know. I mean, we have essentially the United States is responsible for, along with its allies, you know, at one point there were troops from 45 different countries in Afghanistan at the height of the...
And there still are troops from other countries.
There are still troops, yes. Now there are about 8,000-9,000 American troops and 4,000 or 5,000 other troops from NATO countries.
And then are there an additional contractors from the UN and from the...
Yes,
UN?
For every... army person, there's one contractor at least who does the logistics for the army. So at one point when there were more than 100,000 American NATO troops, there were that many contractors from third countries.
And
so I think, if the United States left the country, there will be a massive civil war right now.
And it would be with many different parties.
Different fighting groups. Shiites against Sunnis, Tajiks against Pashtuns, North against South, this against that, the criminals against the common people. There will be a bloodbath, I can say that. And there's a lot, because there's a lot of bad blood. There's a lot of hostility for accumulating for years and years for a variety of reasons you can imagine. So, and we created that. I mean, the United States, true. It is true that in the last 16 years, little has been done in terms of economic development, peace, governance, education, healthcare, social services, employment, infrastructure. Very little has been done. So while $1 trillion was spent on the war and $120 billion on so-called nation building.
And
but
still,
there's
we can't
there's
see
hardly
the,
$1 billion what? Dollars worth of nation building. So in a way, we broke the country. We destroyed it pretty much, socially, culturally, politically, and so we're responsible. But the way to do that, I think, would be not to just pick up and leave, which is not an option, because I don't think the United States would leave. I think the United States wants a permanent presence in that part of the world. This is what critics and analysts will tell you. But I think what it should be
all
done is
those
to demilitarize.
Giant bases.
I think what must be done is to really demilitarize the situation in Afghanistan and really work on nation building and development and plan on a gradual withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. I think, withdrawing right away would be another crime, a crime on top of a crime.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think it's an important point. It's an important thing for us to try to look at, and we can't just be satisfied with saying, well, we can't withdraw, so we just have to keep doing what we're doing.
Bombing, I mean, that's not an option either, because it has not worked. Not only has it not worked, but it has worked against American interests.
Well, and this is, according to all sources, the bloodiest year of the war since 2001.
1,800 civilians killed so far in the first 6 months.
Yeah, and those numbers always sound odd to me, because there have to be a whole bunch more than that were injured and displaced.
Things like that happen all the time. And the death amongst the Afghan National Security Forces, more than 10,000 of the Afghan National Security Forces were killed last year that were counted for. You're right, people who, the collateral damage kind of, that you never hear about.
Yeah, there's so much of it. There can't be so many displaced internally.
I mean, this is a country on fire. The press, local or international, can't go to a lot of places. The press cannot leave their fortresses in the big cities. So it's really difficult to give an account. But the UN has been keeping count. And again, so far, this has been, last year was the bloodiest in the 16 years. This is the bloodiest year in the last 17 years.
So the danger of it exploding into even more violence is right there all the time.
Indeed. And the hostility is there, and the weapons of violence are there. And there's just no accountability. And also just the psychology of the people, death and destruction, murder, mayhem, has been sort of normatized.
Well,
it's perfectly normal. You can hire, suicide bombers.
Well, and it might also be normal to have symptoms of post-traumatic stress. I can't imagine that people who have been subjected to the bombings are not having elevated startle, for example, where they jump and they're afraid at the strangest things, or, those kinds of reactions are human, and they would be going on among the children and the adults as well. So I imagine there's huge numbers of people who are in high levels of anxiety all the time.
Yes, studies show that, by Johns Hopkins in Harvard University and UNESCO, the majority of the people suffer from some kind of psychological problem. I can tell you this, that amongst our students at AUF and staff and faculty, foreign and local, you know, we have problems. I know, absolutely. I'm sure I cannot be immune to, you know, PTSD.
Nobody can be. And some people are more prone to it than others,
yes,
but
yes.
It's a natural response of the body to try to protect ourselves from the next potential
assault. People are always on edge. You know, people are very insecure, very anxious, very irritable. People get into fights very quickly. And when they get into fights, you know, you get weapons used in the first 5 minutes. So you hear, you know, in the press, for example, disputes over land or water or this or that, you know, a debt or a shop or women, you know, and people get killed on both sides very quickly. It's just normal.
Yeah, it's we're coming to the end of our time together, Professor Wahab, and I really appreciate all of the knowledge and experience that you bring to us about what's happening in Afghanistan. Like so many of our fellow, you're welcome. Like so many of our fellow progressives or liberals, whatever you want to call people who would like to see a better world, there's no easy answer for what we can do to support the people of Afghanistan, but a call for demilitarization, a call for not
genuine development.
Genuine development and no privatization of the military any more than there already is, I think are all things that we can all say when we're talking with friends. The other thing I wanted to let you know out there in the audience that you can do is this show right now will be archived within an hour. It will be on the website under today's schedule, under this show. You can just, right at the bottom of it, you can easily share it to Facebook, to Twitter. You can put it on your email list and send out the link to friends. Educate everybody you know about Afghanistan from today. That makes a huge difference. If you can do nothing else, share today's talk and pass it on. We're now running out of time. I want to thank you once again.
Thank you for having me. Thanks, KBOO, and places like KBOO.
Yes, and we will keep our hearts and our minds with you as you return to Afghanistan and be thinking about you and looking forward to the next time we can hear from you.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I want to thank Tammy, our engineer today. Our director of the AM News is Derek Crooks. I want to thank him for setting up this interview. And I want to thank all of you who listened and called in today. You do make a difference, even just with your ears.
And we must make a difference.
And we must make a difference. That's right. So thank you again for being KBOO listeners.
Yeah, thanks.
It's 10 o'clock here at KBOO, KBOO Portland. We have one announcement, then we'll get right to Air Cascadia.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Montevilla Jazz Festival, Saturday, August 19th and Sunday, August 20th at Portland Metro Arts in Portland.